I want to talk today about one of the more important indicators of your spiritual health, and it's one that we rarely pay attention to, especially when it comes to thinking about how it's a dashboard indicator of our life with God, but it's incredibly important. But first, there's a guy named John Stiglow who teaches the history of landscape class at Harvard University, which is by far one of the most popular electives that Harvard teaches. And what's interesting about it is he's just teaching a lot of incoming freshmen and sophomore ways of looking at the world that's always been there, but that he says we move way too fast to be able to see. And one of the first things John Stiglow does in his class is he puts up a picture of something that everybody in this room has seen multiple times, but only certain people can really truly see. Because those of us who have learned how to read, when we see this, don't really see everything. But children who have not learned how to read there, they, when they see that an X, E-X, do you notice what's in there? An arrow. It's a hidden symbol that's always been there. But for us who know how to read, once we see that, we just read the words. We just read the word. We can't actually see the symbol. And he goes through a lot of different examples to say, this is all around you. It's in the buildings. It's in all the symbols and signs around you. And he says, we have learned, John Stiglow says, we have learned to see everything, but really nothing at all. Because we move so fast. But as we've seen in this series, one of the things the Apostle Paul wants us Christians to realize is that God is always at work, and God is always good. And that changes how you see things. That's one of Paul's big things, is he's trying to reframe for people how to see things through the lens of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because in the Bible, have you ever noticed that in the Bible, sometimes the worst thing God can do to you is give you exactly what you want? Have you ever noticed that? And sometimes the thing that you would most, you would never want, the things that you would never wish on yourself or anybody else, is sometimes the best thing God can do through you. Not for you necessarily, but through you. It all depends on how you look at it. And that brings us to today's text. So we're in a series on this little book in the New Testament called Philippians. And you can turn your Bibles to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians is written by Paul, a prisoner from jail, to a little church that he planted in northern Greece. And this little church is in the middle of some kind of church fight. And Paul is writing these people from prison, trying to remind them of the story that they're in. And you need to remember, Paul loves these people. He realizes he's not always going to be around to write these kind of letters. And so he's trying to get them to figure out or to see they've got to learn how to follow Jesus without him. And so that's what's going on in Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 12. Here's what Paul says. He says, therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Remember that phrase, fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill His good purposes. Continue to work out your salvation. Wait a second, Paul. I thought it was by grace that we have been saved through faith. Work out our salvation. How many of you, when you hear this, you immediately think of like personal salvation? You don't have to raise your hand, but how many of us, when we hear that, we're just, you know, that's American individualism. We hear this and we think immediately, I got to work for my salvation. But actually, when Paul says, almost every time in the New Testament letters, when Paul says you, it would be better translated, and this is really good for the South. What you should hear, there should be a translation for Southern people, because what you should hear is work out y'all's salvation. I'm serious. It's a plural Greek word that Paul's actually using. What he's saying is work out your unity in salvation. And this is really important because we live in a world that thinks that God helps those who help themselves is in the Bible. It's not. That's who is that? Somebody tell me. It's Ben Franklin. And that is not in your New Testament. That's actually what some of us hear when we hear this, Paul saying, work for your salvation, is the exact opposite of what Paul says in a lot of other places. Paul isn't saying work for your salvation. Paul is saying we have got to work out what it means to be the saved people of God together. That's hard to do, but that's always been the calling of the Church of Jesus Christ. Now here's the reason it's important for you to hear that. Have you ever gone to the gym and notice that there are certain people that tend to hang around the gym that don't like working out, but they like being at the gym? Maybe it's they're like social butterflies, maybe they're extroverts, maybe whatever it is, they're there, but they're not doing the things that are necessary for them to actually become a healthier person. Sometimes, you know, you think, maybe they just forgot why they signed up in the first place. Sometimes I run into those kinds of people at church. Kinds of people who show up to a building and think that's what means to be the church, right? Often our churches are filled with people who are the equivalent of going to the gym and eating Twinkies and getting frustrated that they're not getting, you know, in shape. Yeah, you're there, but it's not doing what you hope it will. Paul is saying to the Philippian people, you have been baptized into the kingdom of God, and so now you live like it. Now you work out together what it is, what it looks like to be the saved people of God. See, and this is really big. The gospel is not opposed to effort. The gospel is opposed to earning. The gospel is opposed to merit. You didn't earn this free gift of God. You've been saved by God, not by anything that you have done, but by the saving work of Jesus. But, and this is a big one, God didn't just save you. God saved y'all, people you wouldn't have necessarily chosen, people you wouldn't have voted for, people you wish you could vote off. That's who God saves. And if you're not rubbing shoulders on a regular basis with other Christians that you don't necessarily like, but you are called to love, then it's like going to the gym and eating Twinkies. This is what Paul is saying. You have to work out your salvation. The people that your natural enemies, you've got to learn how to live in community with each other. Because, and this is, I love Brother Dan having us pray the Lord's Prayer together. Did you ever notice that Jesus in the Lord's Prayer, when He teaches us to pray, connects the forgiveness we receive from God with the way we forgive each other? If you're not having to pass on that forgiveness, you might find yourself becoming less and less grateful for the way God has forgiven you. And Paul is saying in this little passage, look, I'm not going to be there forever. I can't be with you as you work out. You know, they're having a fight. He's like, I can't work out every single time you get in an argument with each other. But you've got to learn to live and forgive each other. And just because I'm leaving, Paul says, don't worry. You are not going to be alone. God is with you still. So, how do you know if we're doing this correctly? How do we know that when we gather together, when we are in life group together, when we're sharing life together, it's actually doing what we hope it will? And to that answer, Paul gives a really, to that question, Paul gives a really interesting answer, but it's one we don't pay attention to. And it is one of the most important indicators of your spiritual life, to which we have largely ignored it. But before you can understand Paul's answer, you have to remember who Paul is. Paul is not just a church planner. Paul grew up a Jew. He was a Pharisee, a rabbi, which means in his bones is this story of the Hebrew Scriptures that start off with a God who creates the world, then creates a group of people, and this group of people are enslaved by Egypt. Then they're brought out of slavery, right? And that's what the text of that Brother Dan read earlier was today. They'd just been delivered from slavery. They had, you know, God had broken the bow of Pharaoh. God had broken the oppressor. They had walked through on dry ground. God had parted the Red Sea, this miraculous thing. Then they get out in the wilderness, and after just a couple of weeks of being in the wilderness, you know what they start doing? Look at this, Exodus chapter 16. They start complaining. They start complaining, and they say, you know, if we could only have the potted meat we had back in Egypt. You know things have gotten bad when you're dreaming about Spam. Potted meat? They start looking back, and the Hebrews, you know, Hebrew actually doesn't have a lot of words. The Hebrew language only has 6,000 words. But did you know that 5 of those words are for complaining? And almost all 5 of those words are used in this little story Brother Dan just read you. They're just complaining and complaining and complaining. And it's so funny if you're reading the book of Exodus, because God and Moses take turns wanting to kill the Jews. Moses, you know, God is like, I'm going to smite them and I'm going to start over with you, Moses. And Moses will pray and say, no, give them another chance. And then the next chapter, Moses is like, all right, you win, God. Let's do it your way. Let's start over with me. Because it's just so, and by the way, this is a good reason why we need to honor leaders. Churches of Christ especially have not been very good at this. We've been really good at doing what the Jewish people did. Some of us think it's a spiritual gift to criticize and grumble. It's not. It's a good reason to honor. Because most of the ministers and shepherds I know are not trying to be tyrannical power play people. They're just trying to serve by leading, and complaining and pointing out all the ways that it's not happening without knowing all the information or pointing to how some needs aren't being met is not a spiritual gift. In fact, according to Paul, it might be something that's holding you back. Again, I don't know this church well enough to know if I'm addressing something directly. I'm not reacting to anything. I'm just telling you, in our tribe, that tends to be something that we have done really well. And Paul would say, that is not a spiritual gift. It's something that is holding you back. So, here's what he says in verse 14 of this chapter. Do everything. And if you would do this and you would apply this to your life, it would change your life. It would certainly change your spouse's life. It would certainly change the people around you's life. And here's what Paul says. He says, do everything without grumbling or arguing. That's the same word used in the Greek version of the Hebrew passage of Exodus 16. Do everything. You've been delivered, Philippians. God has raised Jesus from the dead. You're a part of that. Your life is in with Christ. Just like those people, don't be like those people. Do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine like stars in the sky as you hold firmly to the word of life. And then I will be able to boast on the day of Christ that I did not run or labor in vain. But even if I'm being poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and service coming from your faith, I'm glad and rejoice with all of you. So you too should be glad and rejoice with me. He's writing this because some of them are complaining and grumbling, and he's reminding them not just of their story, but he's reminding them of his story. They're complaining, but he's the one in prison. They're the one who are upset, but he's the one who's about to be executed. And he says, my life is being poured out like a drink offering. It's sacrifice language. I love this. Paul is looking at his own life and death, upcoming death, and he sees it as a sacrifice to God. He doesn't care what Rome thinks about his death. He doesn't care what Caesar thinks. Oh, this is going to be a great coup. We're going to stop the Christians. Paul could care less what Rome thinks about his death. What he sees is that my death is a sacrifice to God. And he's saying to these people, listen, before I go, I want you to see God has used me to start something in you. So make me proud and do for each other what I've done for you. And do you see what Paul says? If you do this, if you live like this, you will shine like stars. Why? Because nobody else is living this way. Why? Because it's dark out there. And the world needs to see a different way of being human. One that's not so focused on what we're not getting. I am convinced, and this is true across the country, we are more discipled by the gospel of American consumerism than we are the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's why we complain. That's why we grumble. Paul has discovered a kind of joy, and he wants to give this to them, to us. That's a kind of joy that's not contingent on your circumstances. Contentment, and this is what Paul's going to get at. We'll talk about this as we close out this series in a little while. Paul has learned that contentment is not a destination, it is a determination. It is not a matter of chance. Contentment is a matter of choice. And it is really hard to learn this lesson in a culture that is dedicated to creating discontentment. You don't know why? It's our whole economy is based on this premise that we don't have enough. That what we currently have isn't enough for us to be happy. We're immersed in a society. Every time you turn on your radio, every time you turn on your television, every time you open a magazine, every time you drive down I-30, you're reminded, every billboard is reminding you of what you don't have. So much so, it is really easy in the world we live in to forget what we do. You don't have the latest car. You don't have the latest iPhone. Your clothes aren't the greatest. So here's a question I think, Paul, this is what Philippians wants to ask us today. Has the culture of perpetually dissatisfied culture affected your joy? Because it hadn't Paul's. Paul knew plenty and Paul knew want, but Paul knew most plenty of want. He didn't have everything, but yet he's full of joy. Okay, so this is one thing to preach, another thing to live. About 8 years ago, when I was at Highland, I went with a group of people to Nepal to work with this organization that was fighting human trafficking. Really great organization, Eternal Threads. Anyway, we spent 2 weeks in Nepal with the editor of the Christian Chronicle and just trying to show people in Churches of Christ all this stuff. And at one point, after 2 weeks, it got up to 120 degrees. It was incredibly hot. And I was trying to be a brave soldier. And it was just a hard trip. We have one break day. And so it's at this hotel that's really nice. It's like on like a little island. But you have to take a ferry to get there. And we had to drive like 6 hours down windy Nepalese roads to get to this ferry. And I was hot. I was miserable. I needed to go to the bathroom for, 2 weeks. Anyway, it starts to rain while we're waiting on the ferry. And at one point, me and my buddy Matt get on the ferry, and this Indian family, like a mother and a baby and her children, force their way onto the ferry because they don't want to wait anymore. It takes like 45 minutes for the next ferry. And when that happens, they say, okay, we got too many people on the ferry, and they kick us off, me and Matt. And I was ruder than I have ever been in my life. I was like, this makes a lot of sense. Kick off the people that were already on the boat. I was so mad. I was so angry. And I called Leslie later that night. I was still so mad. I was trying to explain her the story. And in a way that only a spouse can, Leslie goes, wait, did you say there was a baby? And I was like, yeah, but I was hot and I was tired. I need to go to the bathroom. And she was like, and it was raining on the baby. And I was like, yeah, but listen. And she goes, man, you would have been horrible on the Titanic. Women and children, second, You ever notice? It's easy, in hindsight to look and say, man, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Is it possible for you to do that in your presence? Is it possible the reasons that we complain aren't as noble as I make them sound? But the reason I'm complaining is because I'm selfish. And maybe God is trying to do something in those moments. Something God can only do when we don't get exactly what we want. In those moments where you feel disappointed, in those moments where you don't get exactly what you want, you find yourself irritated and complaining, it could be a good sign. Instead of focusing on what you're complaining about, what if you focused on why you were complaining about it? Because it could be a good sign that something has become more important to you than it should be. Disappointment can reveal that you've put intense hope and longing in something outside of God. It can reveal your idolatry. So if you're to identify your greatest disappointments, what would it be? Your career? The lives of your children or your family or your marriage or your church? Is it possible that our disappointments is God's way of reminding us of the idols in our life? And if you're brave enough this week, maybe in your life group, what if you asked, what do I typically complain about? That's a scary question to ask because you might actually get answers. What do I typically complain about? Because if you constantly complain about your financial situation, maybe money's become too important to you. If you're constantly complaining about like a lack of respect in the office, then maybe what other people think about you has become too important for you. Paul talks so much in this letter about gratitude. He talks so much in this letter about gratitude for what God has done. He has learned the secret of contentment no matter what he has or doesn't have. Back to that story about God delivering the Israelites through the Red Sea. There's a famous rabbinical story about these two Jewish men who are being delivered. You know, they're walking through, they've walked through the Red Sea. They're being delivered from slavery. And all they're doing is complaining about how muddy the ground is. They've got their head down, and they never look up to notice the walls of water God is holding back for them to cross. This is a real temptation for every one of us, to forget to be grateful for what God has done. It is easy for us to fixate on what our life is missing or compare our lives to somebody else. But Paul knows the secret of true joy is not found in looking at what you lack, but in what God has already done for you. And if you realize what God has done in Jesus, it puts the rest of it in perspective. So here's what Paul's going to do. We don't have time for it today, but Paul is going to then, for the rest of this chapter, he's going to talk about Timothy and Epaphroditus. And he's going to give them as examples of people who their lives are hard, but they're actually living out the best kind of life. So Epaphroditus would have been the one who brought the letter back, and they would have seen him as a failure. And Paul is saying, no, 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 look at him. He's not a failure. He's a success. He's the kind of person whose life, the life of Jesus, is fully in. To encourage this little church in Philippi to stop looking at the mud and start noticing the things God has done around them, to start noticing the walls of water parted around them, Paul gives them examples of Christians who have lived differently. You know the phrase he uses, work out your salvation with fear and trembling? You know that's an Old Testament phrase? It's a phrase that happens when God was in somebody's midst and they did not know it. Work this out, Paul is saying. And remember, God is with you. This is who the church is called to be. A place learning to love and sacrifice for each other. Work for unity, a real Christian unity, not a passive-aggressive Cold War ceasefire, but loving each other in spite of our differences. Not complaining about what is or isn't happening, but joy in the face of these challenges. That's what it means to work out your salvation. And the best indicator I know of what kind of spiritual life you have is how good are you and not complaining. Not that there's not sometimes things that need to be pointed out, but are you content? Are you able to rest without having everything that society around you tells you you should have? If the church doesn't learn how to live like that, to live together in unity, to face hardships with joy, are we really being church together? Are we like the surgeon who passes out every time she sees blood? Are we like the kindergarten teacher who doesn't like kids? Are we like tall people who are smart? Because it all depends on how you look at it. Once you realize God is always at work and God is always good, whenever something happens, your immediate thought isn't, now, how am I getting cheated here? But I wonder what God is up to. And that brings me to my friend, a lot of our friends, Brent Adams, who, as Paul used a personal example to kind of give an example to that church, Brent strikes me as an example for our church of somebody who has gone through hard times and has learned how to do it like Jesus would.
As a young kid, I grew up riding motorcycles. Did it with my whole family, my brother and I. We spent almost every weekend in the woods or at the track racing or riding bikes. When I moved back to Little Rock, I decided to get back riding again. And it was December 8th of 07. I went to the track. It was a horrible weather day. And I hit a jump like I had done many times before, and something went wrong on the jump, and I ended up coming down wrong and had a horrible accident. I landed on my head and shoulder, and my bike landed on top of me and literally crushed me. When they got to me, I was knocked unconscious. When the accident happened, they didn't think I was going to survive it. I had a lot of internal damage. I broke most of my ribs, and they punctured my lungs, and I was losing a lot of blood internally. I also fractured my eye sockets and had a frontal lobe brain injury. Shattered my left shoulder. I think they said I broke a total of 11 ribs. When I first came to, I was still on a ventilator and I couldn't talk. So I remember waking up and it was dark in the ICU. A doctor was standing over me, and he gave me a marker board, a small little marker board that I could write on. And I wrote, "Will I ever walk again?" And he looked at me and he said, "Nope." I remember I closed my eyes and I said a prayer that night like I've never prayed before in my entire life. When I prayed that night and just begging for him just to take this from me, that I didn't want to have to go through this. For some reason, a peace came over me. Like it was so surreal. Like I've never felt a peace like that before in my life. Like literally, I've never poured myself out to God like that before. And I literally felt like he was in the room with me, that he was literally calming me down and just basically saying that I'm going to take care of you. I had to make the decision on how I was going to let this affect me. You know, I'm not going to let this beat me, you know, despite any limitations I may have, it's not going to determine the rest of my life. And so just the peace that I got from praying and the peace that I got from laying that before God, I think that helped a lot with me in realizing that I'm not going to let this, you know, I'm not going to let this be. In many ways, my life is better now than it really was even before the accident. I mean, physically, obviously not. Physically, you know, back then it was a little bit easier, but I think mentally, spiritually, emotionally, that the accident has made me a better person. Like it made me realize that, you know, where to put my priorities in my life. I think that you're at your best when you are vulnerable. I think that, you know, people put on many fronts. They put up fronts in everything they do. You know, I always felt like I was, you know, that I controlled the world, I controlled my destiny, I controlled my fate. You know, it's just, I put everything into my hands. But I think when you're at your most vulnerable, when everything is stripped from you and you have nothing left, nothing else to rely on, you can't rely on yourself anymore. I think that was when I came to the realization of just how much I needed God at that time. Because the peace that I got through that was, you know, they talk about peace that surpasses all understanding. I'll never understand the peace that came over me when I just laid it all at his feet and been like, you know, this isn't the life I wanted. It's not the life I would have chosen. But if in some way that this is how he wants to use me, and if this is a way that people, you know, would want to grow closer to God through what I've been through, then, you know, I'll do it again tomorrow. I mean, it was worth it then.
And talking with Brent, one of the things he said that I loved was, I didn't know this, but Pleasant Valley held a blood drive when that happened because his life was in such peril. And he was talking about how much this church meant to him, but he said, "They're literally a part of me now. Your blood is in me." And that's kind of what we do every week to help each other get through this. I'd like to invite our shepherds to take their places. Do you notice what Paul says happens when we live this way, when we don't grumble, when we learn how to be content? We shine like stars. You want to know that's why the first Christians actually grew so quickly? Because there's this liturgy that started happening when Caesar started persecuting them. They would start questioning them, and Christians started developing this thing to respond by saying, when people would ask them questions about what are you doing, disavow Jesus, they started chanting, "To God the glory." That's what they would do. Even when Caesar dipped them in oil and lit them on fire to light up his dinner parties, the Christians would die chanting, "To God the glory." They literally shone like stars. You see failure, Paul sees success. You see misery, Paul sees a poured out drink offering to God. You see human torches, and Paul, God sees Christians shining like stars. To God the glory. If you're here today, you got something going on in your life, maybe that you found that you're easily irritated or you're tempted to complain or you're discontent, there are godly men who would love to pray with you and ask God's Spirit to help us be and learn the contentment of Jesus Christ. If you go to them while together we stand and worship.